Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to episode 234. For this episode, I've got a special treat. I've invited Rob Maurer to my channel. Just wanted to say hi.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Great. Yeah. So last month, we did a show on your channel where we kind of flipped the seats where I interviewed you for your channel and your viewers. And so we wanted to do that also for my channel. And I wanted to go ahead and hand over the reins to the show to you so you can go ahead and interview me and grill me. I loved our talk last month, especially I was able to get out like your empire on Neo and pets. I mean, that was just classic.
Oh man, I had so many Neo points.
So I think it just gives a interesting kind of human side to, you know, kind of what we're doing. And
I think it's like a great way to get to know behind the scenes, because, you know, you guys listen to us talk all the time, but don't necessarily have a way to, you know, learn a little bit more about us without someone there asking the question. So we thought this would be a good way to kind of do some of that for our own audiences.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, go ahead, Rob, take it away.
All right, sure. So I think we'll start maybe with a couple of Tesla things, and then I do want to get to more of like the personal details, some of your background and stuff, which I'm actually really curious about as well. So I'm excited to have the opportunity. Let's start with just kind of the state of Tesla. So last we talked, I think it was like right before the S&P 500 inclusion. I think we're up, you know, 25-30% or something like that since then. Tesla's got an $800 billion market cap now. Let's check in and see how you're feeling about Tesla at these valuations.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it with two different angles. One is if we separate the valuation and the stock price and just look at the company itself, which is difficult for a lot of people to do because they're so attached to, you know, the stock price. But if you look at the company itself, I mean, Tesla's never been at a better place. I look at this year as two main factors. One is you've got the 4680 cell production ramp, and this is going to set the whole pace for what Tesla can do over the next few years in terms of how low they get their battery costs, how much production, how many cars they could produce, how fast they could ramp up factories, et cetera. And then the second biggest thing is you've got this autonomy rollout with the full self-driving beta. And this thing is amazing, just what, you know, Tesla's been able to do. And the question mark is, how fast can they roll it out in a safe manner? When is ride release going to happen? How is this going to transition to robotaxi? I'm kind of optimistic that we might see the first deployments by the end of next year of some type of robotaxi in some municipality. That's ultimately like the awesome thing. And then the third thing, actually, in addition to that, is the $25,000 car that if people have been following it, it's actually two different cars where there's a China design team that's doing a China-centered car, and then there's a European kind of thing going on to match the European markets. And personally, I think it's actually going to be multiple cars over time. I think this $25,000 car is actually not one car. I think it's not just two cars. I think it's like a hatchback, a sedan, a small SUV, just different form factors for different markets. And we might see, you know, like the $25,000 car be four or five different models. And this is going to be the vast majority of Tesla's revenue in the next decade, you know, this cheaper car. And that's exciting because it's not just what Tesla's at doing, what they're doing right now, but it's how they've set up the next decade, you know, like with energy and batteries, with autonomy, and then with this cheaper car. These are so big in impact that they do set up the next decade, you know, and that's on a company front. On a valuation front, that's a tough one because it's kind of, there's so many factors outside of our control, and we don't know what's going to happen with the bigger market, the economy at large. And, but overall, like one of the reasons why I still hold Tesla and I'm not so tempted to like liquidate a big portion is because, it seems like over the next decade, we have federal governments that are using monetary policy and printing of money to bolster their economies. And that only kind of, in a sense, inflates asset prices over time, I think. So holding real estate, holding great stocks, all that stuff is like, I'm optimistic toward. And that's where there could be, you know, exuberance, there could be a bubble, there could be, you know, a correction as well. But like, if I have to err, I don't want to err on the side of the next decade being too cautious and, you know, being in cash, et cetera. I want to err on the side of being in productive investable assets, because I think that's kind of where the trend is. So yeah, I won't necessarily try to time the market too much because, you know, I don't have the confidence to do that. But yeah, long term, like, you know, I'm very bullish on where Tesla is headed because I just think they're the best of the best in terms of innovative companies out there.
Yeah, I think that's what's always been so interesting about Tesla is they've always had this like very clear product roadmap that seems far superior to any other company, at least in the space that Tesla plays in. And that's what's always given me a lot of confidence in the valuation is just having that clear roadmap. And you can pretty easily slot those into, you know, your Excel spreadsheet and say, okay, if Tesla does this $25,000 car, the market share for that or the market, total addressable market for that is incredibly massive. And Tesla's at an infinitesimally small share of the market right now. So there's so much room to grow. And then when you layer in what you talked about with autonomy, it's just, that's sort of the next level. So
yeah.
What's your experience with the FSD beta so far?
Yeah. I mean, what's actually interesting on that point you're making is what Tesla is also doing is every product they make or a lot of their breakthroughs are opening up new markets that we don't see yet. Like for example, autonomy, it's solving for passive optical, which robots and drones are highly dependent on. And so in a way, like, and this is kind of mind-boggling for most people to understand, but Tesla is in the lead already, in my opinion, for robotics and drones and the last foot delivery because of their work in autonomy. Like, they don't even have to touch drones right now, but they've solved the biggest problem already, or they're solving it. And so when they need to, they could, you know, pour into solving robotics, last foot delivery, drones, et cetera, and they will take over those markets, in my opinion. I mean, that's just my take, but a lot of this stuff, like, you know, batteries, if you can crack the code for batteries, you solve energy storage and huge trillion-dollar markets. And this stuff is like what's exciting, you know, for Tesla is it, these are so big of markets that the innovations today are really, you know, I guess laying the seeds for many, many markets in the future. And like to see a company like that, that's like really, it's really fascinating and unique in a sense. Yeah.
Well, and I think what's cool about that too is like Tesla doesn't necessarily need to do all of it as long as they have that core technology that can work with other partners. Like we've seen that quite a bit in the energy space where, you know, Tesla's got the power walls, they've got the software and they're working with, you know, we just had that, the news about Swell Energy and the virtual power plant in Hawaii. You know, there's third parties out there that can help Tesla with some of these areas that maybe, you know, just aren't worth Tesla's time to focus on right now. And you know, maybe drones falls under Tesla's purview. Maybe they license out their, you know, their vision technology and their understandings in that space to another company that needs it. And that's where, you know, Tesla as a technology company, when we talk about valuation, that's, you know, it's super clear that, you know, they fall into that space versus just manufacturing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it's a tech company, but it's doing innovation in perhaps some of the largest markets in the world with transportation, energy, and logistics, et cetera. And what's difficult for a lot of these like tech companies eventually is they hit a wall. They don't know what to get into after a certain point because they've solved their niche. And for Tesla, a lot of times it's the fishbowl that determines how big the fish becomes. And so to have a tech company in a huge fishbowl where they're the dominant innovator, you know, it's just like, yeah, it's a crazy, you know, time, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So back to the FSD beta then, what's been your experience with that so far?
Yeah. So I have an early 2017 Model 3 with full self-driving package, but I got into the early access program. I just got an email about a month ago or so, and then I signed up. And they said, you know, we'll contact you, you know, for beta builds. And supposedly, like, they're supposed to give people a call, a phone call. At least this is how it's happened in the past, you know, a few weeks where they call the person, they say, hey, do you understand the risks involved and, you know, full self-driving, all this stuff. And they make sure, and then they send out a beta full self-driving build to you. So I haven't gotten that phone call yet. I've emailed, you know, early access, like, 5 times and they never reply to me. So I have to like, the only times they reply is if I give a snarky comment, I go,
wow, it's been 5 weeks.
Yeah. I go, hey, I've been emailing so many times. Like, is there anyone like answering this email at all or something? You know, if I kind of, you know, do something just, and then I finally get a response, you know, that's the only time I'll get a response. And the response is just wait, you know, just wait and we'll see. So yeah, I'm anxiously waiting. We'll see. I'm hoping to get it. And yeah, I want to drive out to the, I haven't been out to the new Austin Gigafactory site yet. I just landed in Austin a couple weeks ago. So I want to do, I'm kind of saving it, but we'll see. I don't know how long I can wait, but I want to drive the full self-driving out to the Austin Gigafactory, you know, and just kind of get the full experience. Yeah.
The full Tesla experience, yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was one of the questions I had for you then. So this is a pretty big move. I think you San Diego area before.
Yeah.
Now moving over to Austin. What's that been like so far?
Yeah, it's been good. Austin, you know, can't complain. There has been some challenges because it's, I didn't expect this. There's a winter allergy season here. It's called cedar fever, and it's like pretty intense. And so it's tough to be outdoors a lot during like January and February because of these allergies and my kids. But yeah, it's been great. I think for us, it's kind of, you know, interesting because I'm trying to give my kids a kind of a world experience in their childhood. It's one of kind of the things, a legacy or gift I want to give them, where I want to help them see nature and I want them to see the world. I want them to see different cultures and be immersed in different experiences to expand kind of their views. And because of that, like, you know, we're traveling a lot lately. And so, and it's probably going to grow over time. And so my kids are like 3 and 6 now. Last year we did about 4.5 months or almost 5 months, like on the road, like in an RV. And so
I remember all your podcasts from the RV.
Yeah. So it was like, it was so intense because like, it's so hard to do a YouTube video in an RV because
yeah.
it's
hard enough at home.
Exactly. It's a 25-foot like Sprinter van RV too. Right. And so, but it was fantastic and my kids are loving it. They love nature. When we hit a campground, they know exactly what to do. They take out the camping chairs, they run around, go in the forest, etc. And hitting lakes and, you know, Grand Canyon, picking like huckleberries at Mount Glacier Park and, you know, hanging out at the ocean. Yeah, there's something magical where I feel like my kids get alive, their curiosity gets spiked in. And so because of that, like, we're going to be traveling, hopefully, maybe like, who knows, 6 to 12 months out of the year, I don't know, to different countries, different places. And it didn't make sense necessarily to have my headquarters in California, where like, I'm not really in like partaking in California enough to justify the extra costs of being in California, right? And so Austin just made a bit more sense. And we're actually still keeping our California house for now to kind of, we might visit, we have relatives and family there. So when we visit, we'll have an easy way to kind of, to stay somewhere, you know, when we're there. But yeah, it's more of a strategy of this nomadic, kind of a nomadic kind of experience, you know? So yeah, it's Austin today, but it might be somewhere else, you know, tomorrow, who knows?
Yeah, for sure. Maybe where Tesla puts their next US Gigafactory.
yeah, who knows? Or even foreign, out of the country too, yeah.
Yeah. So how long had you been in San Diego?
So I've been in SoCal for the past probably 20 years or so. Before, I grew up in Northern California near San Jose. And my parents were, my mom actually was like a programmer at Intel. She kind of worked herself up from community college, not knowing anything, barely knowing the English when she first came to the States. That was before I was born. But yes, I grew up kind of immersed in Silicon Valley, went to school at UC Berkeley, majoring in political economics, which was a multidisciplinary kind of major. I really wanted to do an MBA or do business undergrad, but I was reading that it's better to do something else undergrad. So, and that was like one of the best decisions because I got into history and languages and part of the program, I was able to go overseas for half of the year to study abroad. So I did that in Korea. And after college, I spent like 4 years in Korea doing grad school. I didn't know the language at all. I knew a little bit that I took some classes in college, but I wanted to master a second language because I felt like sometimes people can get so insular in their own kind of upbringing that they're not like embracing the world. And so I wanted to do that. And I ended up spending 4 years in like some grad school in the rural area in the countryside of Korea, where I was sleeping with like three other people in like a small room on the ground. That's the grad school experience. It was insane. I was like
straight
the
through for 4 years like that.
Pretty much. I was the only foreigner like amongst my, you know, class. And yeah, it was like, if you want to die kind of like in terms of your comfort and your cultural type of bias and you want to start from scratch, then yeah, I mean, that's definitely one way to do it. I wouldn't suggest it for people, but it definitely was like a rebirth experience where I had to die, you know?
yeah, that's great. I can't even imagine not knowing the language fully and just full immersion for 4 years. That's
yeah,
a
no,
lot.
No, yeah, it was, it was really full immersion. It was just insane. I ended up after a couple of years starting to dream in Korean, like actually like everything. I barely had a chance to speak English during that time because everyone, no one knew English, you know, around. And yeah, but after that, in my 20s, I came back and I started a nonprofit based in LA. And for the next 10 years, I was taking teams and doing stuff locally, but also overseas, trying to do humanitarian projects. Yeah, that was a fantastic time, actually. Yeah.
So what did those kind of things center around for you?
So it's interesting because I was just last night, I was talking to my wife, and it feels like a different life and different world to me. And I probably should share more, but I haven't shared a lot about it. But the background actually is, when in high school, like up until like I had a rough upbringing actually. So I was raised in a quite an abusive family, and in many ways, like physically, but also like we were very tight with money as well. It was extreme to the point where like I couldn't get anything that I wanted, and I reasoned by the time I was like maybe like 11 years old that the way out of all of this was to be rich, right? I was like, that's the answer. And so and I was setting my sights on for money to be the answer. And I had kind of a series of experiences when I was in high school where I'm like, it was kind of like these meaning of life crises, you know, where I'm like, what's the point? Is money really the point? And I started to get connected to like the really desperate, hurting, kind of ostracized, hungry, poor people in the world. And it really bothered me. Like I had many nights where I'm just like, wow, how is this possible that so much of the world could be so poor and desperate? And I remember in high school, I would, you know, go out for like Thanksgiving and Christmas. I would call up a couple of friends. I'm like, hey, let's go to the park in downtown and let's hang out with the homeless people. Let's bring, you know, let's make 30 care packages with lunches and let's just hang out, talk with them. And like, I had a hard time finding people to go with me, yeah. but I'm like, yeah, it's like, I couldn't feel comfortable without trying to figure out what to do. And in college, there was a lot of homeless people at Berkeley where I was staying. And I would actually hang out a lot with homeless folks and get to know them. And I had some really good friends. And I would like take my lunch and just like share, you know, buy extra lunch for some of the people I know and just hang out. And I remember my senior year in college, I'd known this homeless guy for like 3 or 4 years. We were, you know, we had a lot of history together. And I took him to, you know, we're doing, it was a Philly cheesesteak store at Berkeley. And so I'm like, hey, you know, I want a Philly cheesesteak. And then I asked my friend Gregory, I'm like, hey, what do you want? And he ordered something. And then the owner comes to me and takes me aside and he says, like, don't do that, you know? And he goes, after a little bit, you'll stop doing it. You'll know what I'm talking about. You must be a freshman, right? I'm like, no, I'm a senior. And I've been doing this for a long time. Like, what's the point? And I know at that moment it clicked. I'm like, wow, it's like there's something about it where it's so easy to get like cold and to ignore like what's going on around on in the world. And that's when I kind of just doubled down. I'm like, this is messed up, you know? We really need to do something about those who have less and who really are on the edge, you know? And there are a lot of people on the edge. And so in my 20s, after grad school, coming back to LA, I'm like, you know, I chose LA because I'm like, I think there's a lot of needy people, a lot of people on the edge, and I want to be close to them. So I chose the inner city. I wouldn't say the worst part, but it was close to a very good part. It was on Crenshaw and 10 and the 10 freeway, which is kind of smack center of LA. And I chose a place there and I rented a room in a house with three other people who had rooms. And my rent was $350. We shared a bathroom, which is like, when I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, that was a filthy bathroom. and believe it or not, I stayed in that $350 room pretty much like for 8 or 9 years, like up until I got married when I was 33 or 34. And I was paying $350 rent, living in this place. And I'm like, I'm just going to go to, you know, I started a nonprofit, but I'm like, I'm going to go to the people who need the most help. I found like a center who dealt with like teenage drug addicts who are in rehab. Also, you know, hanging out with the homeless people there and trying to find a way to like, how can we rehabilitate the mind? How can we really help people from a really foundational level? And alongside that, I would also do these international things where we take teams to different countries that are really kind of desperate. And we would do different projects where sometimes we would scope the area, other times we would help existing NGOs and people there on the ground. It'd be with orphanages or just feeding projects or different stuff like that. And as I'm doing this, I'm like, wow, man, like it's like we went to some of the hardest hit countries in the world and we saw some of like the most brutal stuff. Like it's like hard to even, you know, verbalize like what the stuff we saw. But in the midst of that, I started to really get a deep sense of like, of some limitations of resources. We just didn't have enough resources. You know, whatever we wanted to do, it was like, we're always like lacking. And it was like always hard to get donations, you know, it was just like pulling teeth. And that's when like, I also saw,
That's all right. Sorry, Dave. Take your time.
I might have to cut this a bit, edit it, but sorry. I mean,
gosh. It's all right.
Like I haven't really.
It's a difficult topic.
I haven't really talked about this that much in quite a while. So, I think, so what ended up happening was as I was visiting these places and engaging with people, I started to see a flip side of things too, where I started to see businesses and economy. And I started to see like, even in the worst hit areas in Africa, in Central Asia, certain parts of Asia, we would see businesses that were thriving. And it was such a juxtaposition where we'd see just crazy needs and just unbelievable stuff, but we also see vibrant businesses and the economy growing just in immense amounts of ways. And so I started to like think about this, and I'm like, how do I process this? You know, in the hardest hit areas, you have crazy needs, but you have crazy opportunities. And that's when I started to ponder. I'm like, you know, what if you could really tap into the power of business, you know, and the power of investing, the power of the economy, but do so in a way where you can actually embrace and help people and address a lot of the needs out there. And as things start to click over time, and this is over several years and many, many kind of years and trips and experiences, I started to get a renewed interest in business. And every week I would go to this Barnes & Noble in LA. It was that, and I would hang out with a friend. My friend would do mostly like looking at magazines and stuff. I would hit the business section and I would take like 5 or 10 books of the best business books I could find. And I would read like the whole stack in a period of like a few hours, maybe 3 hours or so. And I was able to get really fast at reading because of some stuff I did prior in college and grad school, where I learned how to just read crazy fast. And so I would take like 5 or 10 business books, sometimes even more. And I did that every week, you know, and after a year, you get a pretty good sense of what's out there. And I did that, I think, for about 7 years. For 7 years, I would do like probably closer to 10 books a week, you know, one setting. And after reading like, you know, a few thousand books, I started to really like understand business on a new level. Like I thought I understood business on some level before because I was always fascinated by business, et cetera. But through reading, I was able to understand it on a deeper level. And then through kind of looking at it from all the different angles and kind of things I've experienced and kind of all of the different areas that I'd studied in the past, it really like, it was a transformative experience where I'm like, wow, there's more opportunity in business and investing than most anyone sees. And I started to catch into that. And I got married about when I was about 33 or 34 years old. Ended up getting married to someone who was actually a coworker who was actually helped me in my nonprofit. And when we got married, I'm like, you know what? I have a sense that this is a transition period. Like, I want to see what we could do with business and investing, but do it in a way that can make a big difference. And so I'm like, she had some savings. So I said, okay, let's take a year and let's just explore some business opportunities, some investment opportunities. And let's try to really, you know, see what we could do over a year. And let's not worry about work. Let's just use our savings to pay rent and do stuff. And so it was during that year where I started to, you know, say, hey, is it going to be stocks? Is it going to be trading? Is it going to be business, et cetera? And as I'm diving into this, that's when I started to form some really clear, like, investment strategies. And one of the investment strategies I call it green pastures. And it's a theory, it's a strategy where you just put all of your resources in the most greenest place where your sheep and your flock can grow and multiply. And the concept is most people can't do that because they're wanting to stay close to the city and to the comforts of the city and preserve what they know. But if you're just kind of more adventurous and you work harder to find the best pastures, you just stick them all in there and you see it multiply and reproduce. And at that time, it was 2008, Steve Jobs had announced the App Store. And I was always a big Apple fan with iPods. And I was like, you know, first day in line with the iPhone. And I knew that this was like the biggest thing ever, right? I'm sure like we've talked in the past, like you are a big Apple fan as well. And like when the App Store was announced, this is before they rolled it out. It was just like, we're rolling it out in 6 months or something. I looked at my wife and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like a crazy green pasture. I'm like, this is people don't understand what's going to happen here. Right? This is huge. I'm like, the iPhone is you know, the revolution, and the app store is what everyone's going to use, right? And so I'm like, we've got to just do something. We've got to put in something into this green pasture. And she's like, what are you talking about? We know nothing about, you know, apps, programming, whatever. I'm like, that doesn't matter. and so to make a long story short, basically we end up, you know, paying a freelancer to make an app. And it became like a great app. It was a really popular app, and our team did a great job over the years. And that provided the capital to, it created a new problem where I'm like, okay, what do I do now with some of our savings, you know? And as it grows, like, where do I put it? And it was all connected to kind of, you know, my past experiences, where I'm like, it doesn't make sense to me just to try to invest for my retirement when I'm so just, you know, impacted by the needs of the world, right? And so it made the best sense of where I'm like, hey, let's find something that can really grow significantly to the point where, like, not just 10% annual returns, but can we get 25 to 30% returns? Can we double, you know, every 2 or 3 years? Like, what's out there that can really, like, tap into the power of an amazing business, you know, and the economy, et cetera. And that's kind of the road that eventually led me to Tesla and kind of building out more investment thoughts. Yeah, that's kind of the long story short, though.
That's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing all that. I know that's a lot to go through. I love how it's all connected, though. Like, all of your experiences, you know, learning about different people's circumstances, learning about different situations, leading into learning more about business, and then experiencing that within your own business, and then taking that mentality to investing of like, okay, you know, I've seen my business go from zero to whatever that quickly.
Yeah.
There are other opportunities out there that I can invest my money in that are going to, you know, have a similar result. So, and I think seeing that, you know, you talked about seeing that in, you know, some poor communities in Asia or in Africa, and probably a similar situation there where it's just the amount of wealth and success that is created from business and how quickly that can all happen. I think it's a, you know, it's a transformative lesson.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's definitely, and that's why I like my investing philosophy or strategy is quite different than more of a traditional approach, because like, that's not kind of my aim or my goal. And it's not even my personality. Like, I'm not particularly, like, I have one side where I do understand risks and I do kind of think through things a lot, but I have another side where, you know, I'm not a very high value person on terms of tradition and rules and how it's been done in the past. I'm a firm believer of kind of like redoing things and trying to fix things that are broken. And I think with investing, that's where kind of it was helpful to come in from a completely fresh, you know, view and to say, okay, how can we rethink investing from the ground up and its essence, you know, and what we're trying to do here. And that's helped me. And it's just been, I find it fascinating. Investing is fascinating because it's like, it's just an open field, you know. It's like, you're capital constrained in some ways, depending on how much capital, but that can be solved. It just takes time, you know, it's amazing. I love the field of investing, also business as well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, business, it's like the best game that you could play. Like, the best role-playing game is business, because you have, like you said, you have your fixed assets, but otherwise it's an open world. Like, you can do pretty much anything as long as it's, you know, legal and ethical. It's wide open.
Yeah, definitely.
There's no constraints.
Yeah. I mean, I really like, I told my friends this like early on, like in my 20s, I'm like, why don't you guys like take $5,000 and set up something in the local mall and try something out at least? And you might lose the $5,000, but you're going to gain this crazy experience. And like, the potential of you finding that, you know, that home run, that business that actually that works, right, is amazing. And I got a really close friend who I'm like, hey, let's do something together. This is before I was married. And I'm like, let's do something like cheap, you know, under $10,000. Let's start something. And there's so much risk averseness to that idea, you know, of trying something small. But I love it. Like with my kids, like that's one of the things I want to do is, you know, let them try things out, let them explore and start a business, you know, come up with some ideas and learn. It's like it's a fascinating world, you know, that I think we definitely live in. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because I think sort of your lifestyle leading up to having some capital to invest helped you have a better understanding of risk, I think. You know, that's my perspective. I think, you know, everyone has their own perspectives on risk, but I think because you were comfortable with being able to live a lifestyle where you didn't need to have a lot, once you have something, then it makes you much more comfortable that, you know, I can risk this because if I lose it, I'm just going to be back to the way that I've lived for the last 10 years. You know, it's not the end of the world. And a lot of people think that it is, but especially if you have confidence in yourself and in business that you can, you know, build something and restart and get to that point again, then, you know, it really alters your mindset of like, okay, if I lose this $5,000 or $10,000, there are going to be more opportunities and I can bet on myself to, you know, capitalize on those opportunities and make it back. So why not take that risk in those circumstances?
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. Like this morning, I'm actually, you know, talking with my wife, and the past week we're kind of debating over the type of house, you know, that we want to live in. And I'm kind of like on the side of like, does it really matter? Like, you know, let's just travel more and experience more, et cetera. And, but I think there's also, and that's also partly from my background too, you know, I'm okay with whatever. But I think there is something about also, I think what you're comfortable with and what you expect, which, you know, there's pros and cons. Like I totally understand it too. Like there are benefits of living, let's say, in a nicer area, a more comfortable house, et cetera. But in my case, there's something about, especially in your formative years, like living in kind of really, really humble means, there's something about that and coming to grips with that, accepting that. And it definitely has shaped a lot of my views, you know, like being able to live off of a $350 rent, you know, for a house. I was texting with a friend yesterday and he's like, yeah, you know, it's tough out of college, you know, living in New York City for under $100,000, you know, salary. I'm like, wait a minute. Actually I lived off of under $30,000 salary for like all my 20s, you know, into my early 30s, actually until I got married when I was 33 or 34. And I'm like, and my rent was $350, right? And like, to think about that, wow, it's like, and I'm not trying to glorify that. I mean, I understand, like anyone who's lived with, you know, under $30,000 for that long of a time in a metro area too, that's high cost of living, will understand like how difficult that is, you know, and the sacrifices that it takes to do that. I understand like not having $100, you know, to do something that I really want to do. And I understand the pain of like not having money to save. Like I just couldn't save really. I'm glad I didn't go into debt. Right. But like, I couldn't save more than, you know, it was tough to even save $1,000 a year, you know, if you're making under 30,000 in a high cost city. But that's the reality, you know, for a lot of people. And I'm glad I went through that, not just for a season, not just for like a month or two, but for like almost a decade. It kind of really, I mean, it brings a connection to a whole nother, you know, side of the world. And it's a huge, you know, there's a huge population who's struggling very deeply. And that's one of the things where, you know, yeah, I don't know how I could address that or what I could do in the future, but that's kind of something that is dear to my heart there's frustration from a lot of people who feel there's lack of opportunity. And technology is giving us faster, like Amazon delivery and faster Uber Eats and stuff like that. But for a large part of society, let's say who lives, especially outside of certain tech centers and areas, like they don't feel their lives improving. They're just feeling more, you know, crunched with expenses. And it's not like, you know, we're having a big division in society and the world right now. And we need to find some solutions, I think, or else we're going to see a lot more political, you know, unrest, et cetera. So these are some big issues at hand.
Yeah. So is that kind of what you're thinking about in terms of, you know, your future is, and some of the problems you'd like to address is, you know, is that part of your investing journey, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, it's like the way I look at it also is like, just like when I look at investing, I'm looking for like big impact, you know, like not the traditional way. In terms of giving back and contributing and addressing needs, I'm also trying to look at like big impact. What's something or things I could do that's big impact? And that's kind of one of the whole ethos of kind of my YouTube channel is kind of that, where it's like, okay, I have limited things to give back in terms of time and energy, but also resources. And YouTube seems kind of like an outsize. It's kind of an asymmetric kind of giving back in a sense, where if you really have kind of depth and clarity of thought, of if you have value, even apart from, let's say, the video quality, like, and that's part of my channel is like, it's like hard to find the time and energy to up my video quality. So I just say, okay, I'll just give whatever I could give a value and lay it out. And I kind of trust that value has some amazing, amazing value in certain ways. And because of that, and the power of broadcast, I feel like that's a really asymmetric bet. Like it's giving back, but in a large scale, you know? And I want to do that more in different ways. And like, I want to see people be more open to starting businesses, but know how to do it with small sums of money. And so this is one of the ideas I'm playing around with recently is like, how can I give, say, $5,000 or $10,000 grants to people who want to start their own businesses, where $5,000 or $10,000 is just an amazing sum of money where it could really help them for a whole year to get something started. I won't even take equity, you know, I just wanted them to try, but I want to make it scalable where their efforts help everyone else. Meaning like it's a learning experience where resources are built up, networks are built up, et cetera. Another thing is like giving back to just people, like I shared in one of my episodes, like there's a therapy group in Boston who helps like the most abused kids, the most traumatic kind of adoptees, especially, and different kids who are just on the edge. Like there are cases where some kids are so violent that, you know, they actually, you know, will injure, permanently injure like another kid or like worse. And these are the type of kids that this group, you know, addresses, but they do it in such a way where they have like 100x effectiveness. It's amazing. And I've seen it firsthand, like very deeply, but like in 12 sessions or so, they're able to radically transform a kid. And it's like unbelievable. And I've had to like track this over many years from like, oh my gosh, this group is like, you know, and that's the thing that I'm like, hey, we need to, if resources need to be kind of funneled to the people who can do the 100x in effectiveness, you know, reaching out, because that can be scaled. That's kind of the interest I have a lot. And I'm not sure, I don't have things figured out, but I tell my wife constantly, like whatever resources we have, like I don't even consider it ours. Like personally, it's like we're in and out of this world, this life. Like I'm very cognizant of my imminent future, which is, you know, like we all share the same destination, you know, we're all here and gone. And because of that,
Mars,
I'm like,
of course you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I'm like, yeah, it's a short period of time and we, you know, like, yeah, it's, but I'm very cognizant and aware of kind of resources are in and out of my hands, and we'll see how it goes. But it's exciting though overall.
Yeah, there's a ton of opportunity these days, like you said, for asymmetrical rewards and helping people. So
yeah, definitely.
So getting back to Tesla a little bit, then how does like Tesla come into play with that investing journey? So it sounds like maybe that started out really with Apple, and then was Tesla just kind of a natural segue for you, or how'd that come about?
Yeah. So it started out with business, with starting a company, getting some savings, now having a problem where we'd have this savings account that was growing. And I insisted, I told my wife, you know, let's not put it into any interest-bearing account. Let's get zero interest. She's like flipping out. She's like, what are you talking about, right? She's always known to put something into a CD or something, right? And I'm like, no, we've got to put it in to 0%, like, you know, non-interest yielding account, because we've got to be motivated to find a great opportunity. And so I hate going to the bank, because every time I go to the bank, they'd be like trying to convince me for like 30 minutes to change my accounts and all this stuff, because they're like, what are you doing with this money? 0%, you're crazy. But this went on for like probably 3 years, like, and the amount just kept on growing, or even longer. And we actually had this period where we were really into the real estate market, because we had been following this real estate timing expert in California, and we knew the crash was coming before the crash. Like, this is like back in 2005 and 2006. And when the crash came, we were like, oh my gosh, lifetime opportunity, especially like in certain hard hit areas. And my wife and I, we actually did a tour. We did a tour in 2009, early 2009, where we toured the hardest hit kind of 10 cities in California, Nevada, and Arizona, met with realtors, checked out, you know, neighborhoods, et cetera. And we started to do some investing in real estate, but then after a while and experiencing tenants and kind of an issue with one problem tenant, like, I started to weigh the benefits of kind of real estate versus like our business at that time was doing decently well. I'm like, why don't I just focus on business? You know, it's just like much better, you know, value proposition. And so I kind of wrapped up real estate, but then like we still had this problem of all this cash that we were saving. And so I'm like, okay. And that's where one of the things like I follow a lot is like the developer community or different programmers and the tech kind of the nerds out there who are really into geeky tech stuff. And I follow this site called Hacker News, which is news.ycombinator.com. And it's a Silicon Valley kind of startup incubator. And a lot of just like nerdy, geeky people are there talking about crazy tech stuff. And I noticed since like 2010 or 11, people just talked about Elon Musk here and there in very respectful manner, you know, and Tesla would come up. I'm like, who is this guy that people are talking about, Elon Musk? And, you know, I just kind of passed it off, read a few things, you know, it went along. And then like something in 2012, as Tesla started to produce their Model S, I'm like, wait a minute, could this be an investment opportunity? And so that's when I did like a deep dive into Elon. And I'm like so thankful that Elon had so many interviews that were videoed and also written, where I was able to go through like hundreds of his interviews. Like basically, like I would watch all of the videos on YouTube. I would watch all the videos. And I would go to like every single search engine that was like not Google, just to try to find that one extra Elon Musk interview that was hidden, right? And I'll be like typing these weird like queries, you know, like trying to find this extra thing that I've never seen before, because I had exhausted everything, right? And I go to audio podcasts, I go to all this stuff, and like over 3 or 4 months, like I was just like fixated, and he blew me away with his clarity of thought. Like I think to that point I had never seen an entrepreneur who was thinking so clearly with both technology, but also business strategy. Like I could see it all come together with Elon. And I'm like, wow, man, this is incredible, you know? And I started to invest just into Tesla slowly. And I'm like, I've gotta get a test drive though, because I gotta, you know, feel this. And that's like in October of 2012, I emailed Tesla or Elon Musk, guessed his email address, and a manager contacted me a week later, said, I heard you want a test drive. And I got a test drive and I told my wife, like, if this blows me away, because I had actually kind of driven kind of a good amount of fast cars. Like I was kind of interested in some of those, like, I wouldn't say like high end, but kind of more like BMW M series cars and stuff. And so I'm like, I think I have a pretty good take on what a car can do. And, so I test drove this, and my wife and I, we have this, this slang, we call it the hand of God, where in a car, when it goes so fast, like it's at a certain point, like it's clearly under like probably 4 seconds or something, 4 seconds, 0 to 60, right? Acceleration. Something happens at a certain point where you just feel like something is pushing you supernaturally. It's like, it's beyond like comprehension. It's like, whoa, something just like crazy happened, right? That's what we call the hand of God, you know? And when we floored the Model S, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like the hand of God, but like silent, you know? Like, without the engine. This is like
actually the engine.
Yeah. I'm like, holy moly. And then it drove like, you know, a sports car and like the technology and everything. I'm like, man, if Tesla could just, you know, shrink this car and bring down the cost, like they will take over the world, right? It's pretty obvious. And that's when I'm like, yeah, this is totally worth, you know, our investment. And we started to go like pretty much all in with all of our liquid assets. And the downside, I reasoned where it was like $3.5 billion market cap. And I'm like, hey, they've got a Fremont factory that's huge. You know, it's got to be worth at least $1 billion or more. And then they've got like, you know, the lead with a brand and stuff. They're going to be bought out by at least a few billion bucks, you know, if they fail. So I'm like, I kind of reasoned that the downside could be kind of low, even if they didn't make it. Like I felt, you know, I was pretty, I mean, in hindsight, sure, it could have just completely exploded, right? And gone to zero. But I felt like it was an amazing kind of lifetime opportunity where the downsides I saw were low, but the upside was tremendous. I felt like if they did the Model 3, that would be like a 10X. If they did a cheaper car, that would be another 10X. And yeah, my biggest problem was I just didn't have enough cash at that time, you know? And I would tell my wife, it was like a period of 2 months. This was early 2013. Tesla had already won the Motor Trend Car of the Year. And it was so obvious that this thing was just like awesome, right? And the stock price was still languishing in the low 30s. And I'm like, this is like, it was by March of 2013. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, can't a billionaire just put $1 billion into this and take, you know, like 25% of the company or almost 30%? And I would tell my wife this, my every night for like a month or two, I'm like, shouldn't Warren Buffett or somebody just put in $1 billion? Like, what is $1 billion to them? It's like barely anything. It's chump change. If they put in $1 billion, they'll have as much Tesla stock as Elon Musk does, right? So I'm like, what's stopping this? I'm like, how is it possible that everyone with $1 billion is not seeing this, you know? I'm like, and I would like stay up at night. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, how can I get more money? But yeah, but it was just like, yeah, it was just like a crazy time.
Well, the billion mark is interesting because, you know, many years later, we saw Larry Ellison do the exact same thing, but obviously at a much higher valuation. So exactly. It's like, yeah, they could have done that. The stock price would have gone up and stuff. But
it's
kind of crazy looking back.
Yeah. Or you do some type of like, you know, options, like buy out a bunch of options and try not to make the stock price go up too much. But yeah, funny stuff.
So going from there then, how, you know, have you just, you know, remained steady in that conviction throughout the years? You know, Tesla had a period. So right after you would have bought in, obviously Tesla would have, you know, 4 or 5X'd. And then it had a period where it was in between $150, $300 pre-split for, I don't know, 6 years pretty much.
Yeah.
How did you feel during that period of time?
Yeah. So it reminds me of this one story, like when Tesla made its first spike from like 300 to like 130, it was before it went to 190 and back, but it was the first Test Live conference in 2013, I think July or August or something. And I was speaking to this like really just experienced trader, and he's like, you're crazy. You got to take some off, you know, like you don't know what you're talking about. And like, he's like, I'm a Tesla Model S owner myself, and you don't understand the risk. It's just too risky. Take out half, right? I'm like, no, you don't understand. I spent like 3 hours, I think, into the night talking with him, trying to explain like, hey, like this thing is still has a lot of potential ahead. And on TeslaMotorsClub.com, actually, one of my kind of big, my angles was not just Model 3, but in 2014-ish, I started to really get into what I called the Gen 4 car. And I'm like, the theory was, hey, I think it's actually very, very likely that Tesla does a Model 3 successfully. And if that happens, can Tesla do a much cheaper car? Because the Model 3 still is an entry-level luxury car sedan. It's still not going to tap into most of the market. And I'm like, to tap into most of the market, to get to 10 million cars and beyond, you've got to go to economy cars. You've got to go sub 30,000. And so I started to think about, okay, what would it take for Tesla to go into the sub 30,000, into like a $25,000, you know, car after Gen 3, after Model 3. And so I'm like, yeah, it could take about 5 years or so after that. But I reasoned back then, I'm like, you know, it's really just a matter of efficiencies, economies of scale, drive down the cost, and you need battery improvements. But otherwise, there's nothing fundamentally stopping Tesla from driving, like making a cheaper car after the Model 3, but it'll just 10x their addressable market because it's so much cheaper. And I started to write about this, and I started to get some feedback, actually, or some pushback from some Tesla bulls back at that time. And they're like, you know, that's crazy, you know, that's not going to happen, etc. I still talk to one of them to this day as a friend. But it's funny because I just got so convinced that, not necessarily that that's 100% guaranteed scenario, because nothing's guaranteed, there's always probabilities involved. But I'm like, that's actually the most likely scenario, I felt, which Tesla would successfully do the Model 3 ramp, they become profitable, and that 5 or 6 years after that, they would drive down the cost even further, come up with a Gen 4 car that would 10x their addressable market, get them to eventually 10 million cars or more, and you would see a behemoth of a company, you know? Nothing like what people are talking about now. And that has always kind of driven my investment thesis, like from pretty much, you know, after that first initial 2013 spike, it kind of brought me into a crisis. So what is after Model 3? I'm always thinking kind of what's after, what people are thinking about what's after. Like I'm trying to go a step further.
The second next step.
Exactly, the second next step. So when Tesla went through its kind of harsh times, let's say, you know, the Model 3 ramp, we had some meltdown episodes and some issues, and you had FUD and the markets, or just lots of things going against Tesla. Like that was the main conviction that kept me in Tesla stock, which was basically it's not about the Model 3. Like everyone's talking about the Model 3. I'm like, it's not about the Model 3. It's about what's after the Model 3. You know, it's about the thing that's going to be 10x the product. And I felt like it was still the most likely scenario that Tesla would ramp Model 3 successfully. And, you know, and I felt like it was actually very high likelihood that not just the Model 3 would ramp, but that this Gen 4 vehicle would ramp successfully and become the dominant, you know, vehicle. I thought the probabilities was like high 90s at that time, even with its Tesla's difficulties. So I'm like, it'd be kind of crazy for me to sell now. And I kind of had this fear of like, in 10 years, like if I sold a bunch, you know, like more than, you know, I don't mind selling a few percent a year or something, like, but if I sold like, you know, 50% or something, I would just be like, I would be regretting it so much, I think, in 10 years, just because I knew what was going to happen already. Like I, in my probabilities, I'm like, it's high 90%, you know, that Tesla's going to be able to successfully do a Gen 4 car that's going to 10x their addressable market, and they're going to be the dominant player. And so, yeah, that would be just a terrible position to be in, where I'm like, yeah, I sold, you know, most of my stock knowing that Tesla would be the biggest right. company or whatever ever.
And I think what was nice about that period of time is like Tesla was not even that highly valued, you know, $30 billion or something. It was trading at 2x sales for like a long period of time, you know, 2 to 3x sales, which is like what a normal slow growth company trades at. So exactly. There wasn't even like a lot of pressure to sell. Like maybe there was back in, you know, 2013 when it was more like 10 or 12x sales, but the valuation had become so compressed, people had become so skeptical. But then you have Elon Musk sitting there and, you know, has having done the amount of research you've done on Elon Musk, he's sitting there and saying, you know, we're going to keep growing at 50% for a long time. Mm-hmm. And to your point on the next step, well, yeah. There has to be something beyond the Model 3 to actually continue sustaining that growth. So
exactly.
Yeah. It was just an interesting period of time where there wasn't a lot of belief, but from the market as a whole, but if you had done that research and you had that conviction, you know, it seemed like a pretty clear outcome to your point.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when Elon Musk talks about, you know, year over year growth, 50%, even 20 million vehicles in 2030, it's like he does get pushback from a lot of, you know, skeptics because it's like, how do you get that? You know, it's crazy. But Elon isn't just throwing out numbers out of the dark. You know, he's not just guessing random. He's actually working backwards. He's like, okay, so we get the model, you know, the Gen 4 car out, we sell this many cars, and by this date, there's going to be, it's going to be even cheaper. And we might have, you know, he has his plans where it's maybe even another generation, you know, cheaper, et cetera. And he's working out the numbers and the plan. And he's like, oh yeah, it's going to equal pretty much that, you know, it's not. And in a lot of ways, I feel like Elon is not, like some people think, oh, Elon is like, you know, he's pumping up Tesla and all this stuff. But in a lot of ways, it's the opposite, where he actually holds most of his plans secret, under the cover, where yeah, he's not explaining like what a big deal the $25,000 car is, you know, and he's not explaining like even after the $25,000 car. Like think about it, if the $25,000 car gets revealed, I say end of next year, I say 2022,
yeah, it could even be next year,
yeah, 2022, but let's say production in late 2023 or early 2024. What's gonna happen though in 5 years after that? You know, it's like they're going to be able to accrue all of these extra efficiencies and advantages, cell improvements, so they can either make another cheaper generation car or just drive down the cost of the existing generation and increase the demand further. So it's like, yeah, Elon's not detailing all this stuff, but it's very clear to him, you know, it's like, this is the path forward. It's like, you know, but he doesn't want to make it too obvious, you know, for everyone laying out all the numbers, you know, yeah.
Well, I think what's super interesting, I think we talked about this at one point, I don't remember if it was our last conversation, but, you know, at some point Tesla can actually leverage their technology and the amount of money that they're able to pull in through that to actually even offset offering the car at cost or even at a loss, because they're just accruing money on the actual software. And, you know, to some extent, we've already seen that be the case, maybe not to the point where Tesla's selling their hardware at cost, but certainly as the full self-driving feature set improves and autonomy becomes more of a thing that more people are willing to pay for and adds more value, I don't see any reason why Tesla couldn't or shouldn't do something like that, just to capture as much market share, get as many autonomous vehicles out there as they can, and let that, you know, change the world as it does.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many options, because like if you drive down the cost of the vehicle, it gets so cheap, but then you've got the autonomy package on top of that, where you could do the printer model, where you just sell the printer for nothing and, you know, make money on the usage. And I guess the question though is, I don't think all of that is completely figured out on Tesla's end right now, because a lot of it's going to be determined, I think, in some ways based on competition. There is a chance, I think, that perhaps Google or some other company might make autonomous driving free and try to monetize through ads and other ways and give it to automakers for free that they can market up. And there could be some kind of price pressure and competition, maybe not in the 2 to 3 year mark, but maybe more in the 5 to 10 year timeframe, you know, as, you know, because there's so much money that's being poured into right now, autonomous driving. And I think Tesla is pushing the envelope and they're making all of the right moves, and they will be first in my opinion, and they will enjoy a period of, you know, first mover advantage. But once Tesla cracks the nut, they show everyone else how to do it, you know, and everyone copies that. They'll be behind according to how much data they have, etc. But at a certain point, I don't know the time, you know, it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years, I don't know, but you know, there probably will be some type of parity. I'm not sure how close a parity will be. Maybe Tesla always has some type of edge, but it's possible that, like with iOS and Android, it's like, I would say iOS has an immense edge in usability and different things, but then other people would disagree. You know, they think Android is a better product. And so maybe they can make it up in different ways, you know, like, maybe it's cheaper, you know, maybe it's just, I don't know, has some other features. So I think the ability of Tesla to, how much they could charge for full self-driving in the future will depend on the competition landscape, which, you know, it's hard to tell exactly right now.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. One of the things I spend a lot of time thinking about though is like how does the market evolve to a place where something like that is even feasible for anyone to compete? Mm-hmm. Because Tesla positions themselves so interestingly, where they're not trying to be this like premium automaker. Like that's how they present, because they have to, because the prices are high. But really what Tesla's focused on is scale. And when we think about like an autonomy network, I feel like scale is maybe the biggest, most important element of an autonomous network. I don't know. You know, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that. But when we go into the future, 5-10 years, like assuming Waymo solves autonomy and assuming Tesla solves autonomy, one of those two companies' fleets is going to be 10 to 100x larger. Why would you use a Waymo car if you can get a Tesla car to come to you, you know, in a minute versus waiting 10 minutes for something from Waymo or another competitor? So it's difficult for me to envision a scenario that evolves where it's not like a winner's take all market, or at least a winner's take most market. You know, maybe there's some differences in different areas of transportation, like logistically or things like that. But I don't know. What are your kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah. Like a few things. First is the reason why I have some question marks in terms of, not necessarily, I think Tesla will be in the lead, even 10 years from now. That's the most likely scenario. To me, the question is, will second place be close to Tesla or not very close to Tesla, let's say in 10 years? The reason why I kind of have some question marks is, on one level, it's such a big market where a lot of these tech companies, they have a hard time finding big markets. Like, that's their biggest problem right now. They just can't find the big markets to expand into to justify the growth that they need to justify, right? To justify their stock prices, et cetera. So you have Amazon, you have Apple, you have Google, NVIDIA, et cetera. They all are focused, Intel even, like on autonomous driving, or that's one of their areas, because it's just, they can't afford to miss out on a potential multi-trillion dollar market. But then autonomy is not just dealing with transportation, it's also dealing with logistics, the ability to transport people, but also goods and services. So it's like almost creating a physical web in a locale. Whoever controls that physical web of infrastructure can be kind of a gatekeeper in a sense and charge a tax or a usage fee for using that physical infrastructure. And this is like, this is an immense amount of disruption that's taking place. And Google and Amazon and Apple, they all realize this to a certain extent. And because of that, as all of these big tech companies have all this cash on hand as well, and they can easily raise whatever, you know, hundreds of billions, like, it makes it a no-brainer to try their best to try to take on Tesla in some ways, you know? Especially like, look at Amazon, like if they lose on the logistics and Tesla dominates, let's say, deliveries, not just like delivering food, but they say Tesla cracks the last foot delivery problem. They deliver from the car to the front door, and all of Amazon's packages have to go either through Tesla's infrastructure, local web, or Amazon has to create their own, but Amazon's web is far more inefficient. Let's say it's human drivers, they don't even have last foot delivery, it's like whatever. That's a huge disadvantage for Amazon that's existential in some ways to their dominance. So Amazon has no choice. They have to go all in with autonomous driving and logistics. And so because of the nature of this, the way I look at it is there's going to be big moves in coming years where, you know, I mean, we're starting to see the very, very early innings of it. Like, we're still first inning where Amazon invests into Rivian or something, you know, and Apple is going to invest into other stuff. But I think when Tesla starts to crack this nut and you start to see robotaxis on the road, then it's like mass hysteria, but that's when it's like the writing's on the wall, you know, and these tech companies know that they need to make big investments. And you're going to see, I think, some big, huge acquisitions and mergers and different things that try to formulate some type of behemoth of competition for Tesla, even though I think they'll still be behind. I think China's interesting because you have the ecosystem of Foxconn, of CATL, BYD, of XPeng and NIO. You have manufacturers, you have the cell, you have different, you know, government incentives where they could perhaps, Baidu as well, self-driving, they could perhaps come up with something quite interesting. The difficulty of them, though, is transporting that overseas and establishing the trust in the brand, which takes a lot of time for cars. I think China ecosystem, by the way, Foxconn, some of my viewers are saying it's a Taiwanese company. And yes, I I do want to recognize that, even though they have a lot of operations in China. But yeah, I think there's room for maybe one other big player, perhaps. You have you have the Chinese kind of ecosystem player, you have Tesla, and maybe you have room for one more player that could be Amazon. But it would be it would look very different than maybe what we expect, I think. It could be some type of merger / separate entity or something, but there will be hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars spent to try to keep Tesla from dominating. You know, just like Google was frantic to stop iOS from dominating and taking over the smartphone industry completely. Like, I think there's something that's going to happen that, you know, causes people to be frantic, you know, and the big tech companies to try to do something. So I don't know. I'm doubtful that they can do it, because Tesla is doing what is extremely difficult, is like merging all of the pieces together. Like, not just the manufacturing, not just the service, not just the ownership experience, not just the brand, the batteries, the manufacturing, the software, the autonomy, the factories, you know, the machine that makes the machine. Like, there's so many things Tesla is doing that. How do you copy that, right? It's like, right. like Amazon, Apple, whatever, Google, they have to contract, you know, some, you know, car manufacturer to make the cars for them. And so it is, I have to admit, it is hard to see how they can beat Tesla. It's hard to see, like, you know, that they could for sure do a close second best, but I don't know. I leave it a little bit open, where I'm like, you know, prove me wrong. Like, let's see what the big tech companies can do. Yeah.
I mean, you said it really well. Like, that's why I think we sit here at this $800 billion valuation, and we don't really think all that much about selling, because, you know, rewind 5 years, we had high conviction of, you know, Tesla's on the best path for making electric vehicles. And then at a certain point, they added being on the best path for making autonomous vehicles. And I think we're still on that same path. And, you know, we're not seeing enough or anything really from competitors that shows that a different path would be superior. And Tesla's clearly the farthest along on the path. So it's kind of Tesla's race to lose at this point. To your point, I do think there's going to be fragments that develop. I think China's kind of its own unique set of circumstances. I think logistics, as you said, that to me is a little bit different than like the ride sharing sort of transportation element, because, you know, you have your predefined routes and things like that. You know, your exact use cases, you know, when everything needs to be, where everything needs to be, when it needs to be there. So it's very controlled. And when you have that element of control, I don't think you have as much of a benefit from scale as you would with like a ride sharing, where it's sort of more of like an on-demand type of service. So yeah, Amazon, I'm sure they will at some point figure out how to do this autonomous transportation of their goods and services, mostly their goods, through autonomy. And I think it's probably akin to them sort of, you know, eventually taking over what they originally were supplied from UPS and FedEx. Like, maybe they leverage Tesla for a little bit, but eventually it's just going to make more sense to take that internal. And I think that's, you know, well within their purview of being able to do that, even if they are years behind Tesla. Mm-hmm. But the ride sharing network, I'm not sure how anyone can get into that once the scale is there, as long as the market share leader is not, you know, being greedy and taking an extra significant premium that would leave the door open.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, is like, Tesla doesn't have to be greedy, because their whole ethos isn't necessarily like, you know, become the most profitable company. You know, their priority isn't necessarily shareholder, you know, value per se. They want to promote their mission. And the thing I've been thinking about lately also is this concept of it's extremely hard to have kind of a noble mission, but to do so in a way that actually makes business sense, which actually is a strong business model and returns like more capital to make more investments. It's like, a lot of times you can have like a great mission, but the business side is kind of like lacking a bit, you know? It's so humanitarian that it just doesn't make much money, right? But what Elon has cracked, which is, I think, underappreciated, is he's cracked this nut, which is really hard to do, which is, you have like kind of a humanitarian mission, which is basically to save the planet. And yet you're doing that noble mission in a very like business savvy way, you know, that makes money, but money isn't the priority. And so, and Elon walks this line very, very well. Like, he's super like like he's the, I think the best of the best in terms of even walking this line, where even with Tesla, he doesn't hype up all of its humanitarian things to the expense of, you know, making money. On the flip side, he will talk about business and the model, but he doesn't overemphasize it to the point of, you know, overshadowing the greater humanitarian mission. So he does this very like very interesting tightrope walk where it's like, it's a great business, Tesla is, but it's also a great like mission too. And how do you do both at the same time? It's like, wow. It's like, yeah, this is it's pretty remarkable, I think, what we're seeing happening before our eyes.
And that's I totally agree 100%. And that's across the board with this company. It's like, you look at Tesla, 100% true. You look at SpaceX, 100% true. Neuralink and the Boring Company, you know, I think both of those have the exact same situation where it's, you know, we're trying to solve this fundamental problem and improve people's lives. And through doing that, we can capture, you know, market and get the capital that we need to continue to serve that, you know, solve that problem. So it's super fascinating. And I agree. And I think it comes from Elon's core of like, he really is just trying to solve these problems. Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, business is a great way of solving problems. And I think he's learned that. And that's what he tries to, that's how he tries to structure everything he does fundamentally.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely agree with that. Yeah, definitely makes sense.
All right, let me just look at my list here. See what that was. This has been awesome so far. Company X is on here. I just want to, you know, X holding company. Yeah. I want to get your most recent thoughts. I know you've shared quite a bit on it, but
yeah.
What are your most recent thoughts on that?
First off, I was kind of surprised by the pushback a bit. I think it was my error where I didn't fully appreciate how much the idea that a conglomerate would be discounted in the market. Like how, not just prevalent, but like through sharing the company X idea, I realized that it's not just a theory, it's a law. People accept it as a law. When you bring companies together, you know, the value will decrease, the total value, the total pie will decrease. And it's not even like contested. It's like, there's actually like rules and laws about this that it's widely accepted as like, you know, it's unchangeable. So it's to the point where you say, hey, combine these companies, and generally the traditional mindset is, whoa, value is going to crash in terms of its overall pie, right? So I think I underestimated the prevalence of that kind of angle. I still actually think it's a great idea, and the reason why is, it's again me thinking kind of beyond next, and not many people are talking about like Elon already fulfilling most of his 2018 CEO compensation plan tranches, but the valuation tranches are pretty much, you know, they're over, it's like, that's like half, like 12 of them. And then he's got milestone, you know, tranches. But when the CEO compensation plan first came out, I'm like, these milestone tranches, I think are actually a little bit like easier to meet, I felt, than the milestones. I thought that it was kind of like they did it like very achievable milestones, you know, for the operational. So I'm like, at this pace, I feel like in 3 years, like they're all, you know, or he's fulfilled his CEO compensation plan and he could exit Tesla. And most people assume, oh no, Elon's never going to leave Tesla. You know, it's his baby. He's not doing it for the money, etc. And yeah, I agree. He's not doing it for the money, but that's oversimplifying the process, the thinking. He does it partially like, no, he does it for the mission, but there is an element where the compensation matters because it helps him be able to do other things, let's say like SpaceX, et cetera. And so the question then is, why does Elon stay after 3 years when his compensation plan is done? And why doesn't he just focus on SpaceX at that point? And the other thing is, I think what people don't realize is it's extremely taxing on Elon to lead so many companies. Like when Elon's at the top of his game, he's feeling great. Like, you know, it's probably manageable, but there are times where he likely goes through some rough patches, you know, it's like some problems with his kids, with his partner, with some other things and some physical issues, or there's different ups and downs. And during those periods where it's difficult, like leading a publicly traded company like Tesla, in addition to SpaceX and Neuralink and Boring Company and all these other things you're doing is extremely, extremely taxing. Because as we all know, it's like Tesla is many startups within a startup. It's like, how many people are reporting to Elon Musk? You know, it's like all of these people are reporting, needing his attention. It's like unheard of with companies that size. And so there's this element where I feel like, you know, it could be tempting for Elon to just say, okay, I've done my job. Tesla looks like it's in good place, good hands, and I'm going to focus on SpaceX. If that happens, Tesla's like trajectory, I think, changes. And like one of the big things is I am invested in Tesla. A big part of that is because I think Elon has some special insights and abilities and skills to create huge value from no value. Like he's able to, like, for example, say, huh, what does SpaceX need for revenue? Let's create Starlink, you know, just out of the blue. He's like able to do crazy stuff like that. And that's really, really rare to find. And I, as an investor, I want to be invested in that person. You know, I want that person to be making my investment decisions for me, to allocate capital to the right projects. I think it's, yeah, he's a generational, you know, leader in that sense. And so if Elon leaves Tesla, like Tesla is different. I mean, it's not different for the next 5 years after that, because the product roadmap is set. It's different for the next 20 years in what Tesla is able to do, the risks that they're able to take, the new areas. Like, for example, to me, if Elon stays for the next 20 years, it's obvious where Tesla's going in some ways. They're going into, like, you know, last foot delivery, you know, robots and drones, et cetera. They're going into like more humanoid, like kind of all special purpose, all purpose robots to clean your house, to cook for you, et cetera. They might even go into more efficient housing. They're going to go into, you know, more aggressively into energy storage and generation. And they're going to go into huge areas that is just mind blowing, you know? The trajectory is just on a different level. If Elon stays for 20 years, if Elon leaves after 3 years, Tesla's a great investment. I mean, in a sense, their product roadmap still is intact for a while, but it's like, I mean, a lot of people compare it with Steve Jobs. Like, hey, you know, after Steve Jobs left, look at Tim Cook. Tim Cook did a great job with Apple. And I would actually kind of say there's some similarities, but I think Elon is on a different level than Steve Jobs. Like I respect Steve Jobs. In fact, I listened to every single one of his keynotes for over a decade. Like he was one of my favorite business leaders ever. And I completely grasped like his genius, like amazing, amazing, amazing. But Steve Jobs' genius was very different. He was able to kind of spot what was already happening and kind of create this amazing experience combining humanities and technology with an empathetic view and design and create just a great experience. But Elon is different. Like Elon has that element of what Steve Jobs does, but Elon has this element of, in a sense, kind of creating the future that he wants more than just, let's say, going along with the future and making the future kind of better as it happens.
It's more creator versus, to some extent, optimizer.
Yeah, exactly. In some ways, yeah. I mean, not to discount Steve Jobs, you know, it was amazing what he did, but Elon's done this multiple times and he continues to do this. And that's where I think the comparison is not exactly accurate. I think Elon means more to Tesla than Steve Jobs did to Apple and its future. And so if Elon steps down, completely leaves the company in 3 years, which probability wise, I still think it's probably, you know, less than 30% chance he does that. That would radically change my investment philosophy toward Tesla. I'm not going to say I would pull all of it, but it would definitely make me rethink because, hey, you know, like Elon is my investment manager. That's how I view him, you know? And if the investment manager leaves the company, like, you know, I'll probably try to find a way to, I will try to find a way to follow him, you know, as my investment manager.
I think that's all interesting. And I don't know, I guess I kind of have a different point of view on it because I think, you know, he's so tied into Tesla now and so much of his worth and his ability to use his capital is tied into Tesla. And that's only going to grow as Tesla's valuation grows and as he hits these, you know, option tranches from the compensation package, where, you know, $200 billion of his net worth is going to be Tesla shares. And as a part of that compensation package, that needs to vest over 5 years. Like, he can't touch that 100 million shares through that compensation package for 5 years. So even once he hits that, he still has that incentive to like hang around and make sure that that investment for him is doing the best that he can. And maybe his efforts are a little bit less focused on it, but I think he's still going to be there to oversee the ship at least through that. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where the X holding company comes in for Elon, where he's so interested in it, is because if at some point he wants to try to shift those assets over to SpaceX or to something else, I don't know that there's like a good way that he can do that tax efficiently or even from a, you know, extracting the value efficiently type of way, because if he sells his stock, like you said, people are going to exit and maybe that cuts the value in half, versus if he brings it into this holding company, to your point earlier, maybe there's a 20% hit because it's a conglomerate or something like that on the total entity, but he's still got the ability then to leverage his assets without having to sell them, without having to take the tax consequences. So I don't know. That's why I think it's appealing for him. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that angle of it.
Yeah, definitely. Like, no, I actually definitely agree with that. I think because his assets are tied, he's going to, you know, be interested. The question, I think, in my opinion, 70% chance Tesla reformulates a new compensation plan for Elon Musk makes it worth it for him to stay another 5 or 10 years. You know, taking Tesla from, let's say, $1 trillion to 3 or 4 trillion maybe or something. And Elon stays with Tesla for that time. I think that's probably the most likely scenario. I just think that, like, you know, Elon completely leaving, it's probably a lower possibility. But I think the concern I have, for example, with Elon as an overseer, I think I kind of dichotomize this, where Elon was the board of the chairman of the board for SolarCity. He was their lead investor, their biggest shareholder, and he oversaw kind of SolarCity, but I think that didn't work out. And the reason why I think it didn't work out is because even as chairman of the board and the largest shareholder, you think that you have influence on what to do and what to say, but like Elon was relegated to this role of just saying, okay, looks good, okay, and moving on, where it's like, and he didn't want to step on toes, because there are other people, you know, running the company. Like, so he can't necessarily go into the design studio with engineers and say, do it this way, you know, or make this product, because the CEO has to know and everything. And so I think there's an immense difference when you're the CEO and you could say, let's change this product, let's do this, done. You know, no one is gonna push back on that, right? And I think Elon works best with in that scenario, where his feedback is the law, and he doesn't have to worry about stepping on a CEO's toes and just giving so-called advice. Because the thing is, the way Elon thinks is so, I think, radically different in some ways. His so-called advice, like, people just will discount it. Okay, whatever, we'll try. Whereas he's thinking, like, this is the radical way. You know, 99 out of 100 people might think this is a crazy way, but he knows it's right because of first principles. He thinks the odds are most in his favor. I think the best way to do that is he's got to have that power. Like, there can't be anyone above him where he has to answer to that person. So that's kind of the problem I'm optimizing for, in a sense, is at a certain point, Elon will probably step down from Tesla, whether it be in 5 years or 15 years, in terms of not being the CEO, right? And he might still be the chairman of the board. He might be a chief product officer. I don't know. He might not be the chief. He might just be, you know, holding his shares or whatever. I don't know what it's going to look like in 10, 15 years. But at that point, he's going to lose a lot of what has made Tesla, Tesla, kind of that ability to input radical, you know, product shifts and strategies into the company. And I just think if you put Tesla into a holding company, you preserve that until Elon dies, until he's mentally incapable to do that anymore. And that he's pretty young still, you know, like 49 or so. So we're talking about a good 30 years, probably, likely, if, you know, possibly longer of, and if you think about compound growth, 30 years, 40 years or something over the time, what can happen? It's like, I will take the 20% stock hit, you know, whatever that happened, if it happens, you know, for X company, and trade it in for that 40-year compound growth that will become the greatest company in the history of the world, I think, in terms of, you know, where it's at. But again, it's a lot of that is like me just thinking next, you know, trying to optimize a problem that doesn't necessarily exist at this moment and not caring about the stock price today. But like, I don't want to exit my shares in 10 years or whenever Elon leaves and take tax hit. I'd rather keep it in for 40 years with Elon together, you know, with him at the helm. But the flip side is Tesla's a different company. You know, it's in some ways it's not Elon's baby anymore. It's taken over by large holders, by S&P funds, by, you know, it's a monster in a way, you know? And it's going to be probably difficult for, you know, for certain things to happen just because Elon's saying like, hey, I prefer this way. So yeah, I don't know. I did a poll and it was like 50-50, right? People were for and against it, but that was with retailers. So I would imagine institutional holders would be more against it. You know, what are your thoughts? Yeah. Do you think there's any realistic possibility?
I think there's a possibility because I think, again, like I think it optimizes for what Elon is trying to do. So I think that's why he's interested in it. You know, whether that best serves the shareholders, that's what I think is a really good debate. I think there's good points on both sides. It's interesting that you talk about your poll though, because I did a poll on Twitter too, and me, it was more like 70 or 80% wanted it. So it's really interesting to see the large disparity there.
Yeah. Maybe I wonder what the dates on the poll were.
Think they were close to around the same time. I'll have to go back and look at it though.
Yeah. Maybe I need to do another poll or something to see what the attitude has changed. I just noticed a lot of visceral reactions to the idea when I first shared it.
And I think it depends on people's, you know, priorities. Like if you're an investor in Neuralink, like I don't see any good argument for a holding company. That's going to diminish your upside so much. If you're an investor in Tesla, having those companies under your ownership, I think that's great. So I think there's a lot of, you know, different stakeholders and different opinions, but at the end, like it might just be Elon's that matters. Like he, with his shares, if he can get 25% of other people to agree, like it can happen. So, I do think it probably ends up happening someday. And it's going to be pretty interesting to follow.
Yeah. If it does, it's going to be definitely interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're getting close to our time here, Dave. Thanks for sharing all that. That was I really enjoyed hearing some more about your background and, you know, all your up-to-date thoughts on Tesla is always interesting too. So appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob, for just taking the time out and connecting. Definitely always appreciate chatting with you and appreciate what you do for the whole Tesla community and the work you put in.
Likewise.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk soon.